Thank you. Welcome. There we go. Thank you, and welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And welcome to this Perimeter's public lecture series presented by BMO Financial Group. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach here at Perimeter, and it is a pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening, both those of you here in the live studio audience and those of you watching online, whether on Perimeter's website or on one of our many science communication colleagues' websites around the globe. The lecture itself will last approximately 1 hour, and there will be time for question and answer at the end. For those of you watching online, Dr. Damian Pope and a team of PI researchers are behind their keyboards. They're monitoring the Facebook and the Twitter feeds, and will answer questions and engage in discussion throughout the lecture and even a little bit after the lecture as well. So if you want to join that conversation, please use hashtag PILive. And now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's very special guest speaker, Dr. Michele Mosca. Dr. Mosca obtained his doctorate in mathematics in 1999 from Oxford University on the topic of quantum computer algorithms. His research interests include quantum computation and cryptographic tools that will be safe against quantum technologies. He is globally recognized for his drive to help academia, industry, and government prepare our cyber systems to be safe in an era of quantum computers. Tonight, Dr. Mosca will explore quantum technologies, both those that already exist and those that are yet to exist, and how they will affect our lives. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Michele Mosca.
Well, thanks so much for that very warm welcome and for spending your precious time here with us today. I want to talk about the implications of this new paradigm for physics that was discovered roughly a century ago. A new paradigm is slightly different from a new theory. Right? New paradigm is a mathematical framework in which to express theories, discover and articulate theories. It's like a new language. Okay, so a simple example of a paradigm that we use is, you know, say, or have used in the past, is the flat Earth model, the flat Earth paradigm for describing the surface of the Earth. It tends to serve us well if we're describing small regions of the Earth. So we take, you know, accurate pictures of actual reality, and we try to draw it on a flat Earth, on a sheet of paper, and it works more or less, except when you push it to the limits. Then something goes wrong. And what went wrong wasn't the person taking the measurements made a mistake. There's no numerical calculations. It was just you shouldn't be embedding it on the flat surface. You need to embed it on a sphere. Right? So the sphere is a new mathematical paradigm, which is a more accurate paradigm for expressing the surface of the Earth, for describing the surface of the Earth. Now, new paradigms aren't generally accepted, you know, with welcome arms. You know, Max Planck has this lovely quote about new scientific truths are not accepted because their opponents see the light, but rather their opponents die off. And a new generation grows up that's familiar with it. Now, when I learned about quantum theory, I wasn't doing physics. I was a mathematician, computer scientist, cryptographer. I had no quarrel with quantum mechanics, so why not just be part of the new generation? As another colleague of mine once told me, people don't change their behavior because they see the light. They change their behavior because they feel the heat. So I started to feel the heat of quantum mechanics later on when I realized what its implications were for computation, communication, and cryptography, which I did care about. I'd invested 3-4 whole years of my life in this field. It seemed like a long time for me. So I said, there's got to be something wrong with this, right? So why does quantum theory affect computation? Well, computation is a physical thing. You store information in a physical medium. You manipulate it according to physical processes, and you get some sort of answer, and so on. So you can't have a theory of computation and communication and information divorced from a practical theory of physics, a practical framework for physics. And when you look at the implications of quantum theory on computation, you actually get a fundamentally new mode of computation. There are serious implications, which I'm going to talk about today. I didn't like those implications because it changed what I was doing very fundamentally. But I did, after a few months of my supervisor insisting I read up on things before I dismissed them, I did eventually see the light, and I started working in quantum computing. This is, by the way, a photograph that my colleague Matteo Mariantoni and collaborators took of a 4-qubit superconducting, computer chip. There's four little loops here. Those are quantum bits. The wiggly wires allow them to interact, and so on. You can do 4 quantum bit computations. So we've gone, as you can see here, 100 years ago, we learned that there was a new game for physics. We learned the rules of the game. But it took over a century to start really playing the game and controlling things in a very quantum mechanical way. So we're entering what some people call the second quantum revolution, right, where we can actually store and manipulate things and have very complicated, sophisticated quantum effects that don't naturally occur in nature. And this new paradigm for computation, I initially did not like it, but I eventually realized it actually brings a wonderful host of new possibilities for science, technology, and humanity, which I'm going to talk about for the next little while. So what is it that's underlying quantum mechanics? Why did we need a new paradigm? What was wrong with the old language? It didn't allow us to express a very simple feature of physics, namely that a physical system that can exist in 2 or more distinguishable states can in a special way embody all of those distinguishable states at the same time. I'll try to give you a sense of what that means, but obviously it's not so simple, and of course we invented a new paradigm because we couldn't express it in terms of the old paradigm. So imagine a bit of information, a 0 or a 1. It's encoded in some physical medium, for example, an electron in the ground state or in the excited state of an atom. That's a perfectly good bit, physical embodiment of a bit. Quantum theory says that such a system can actually be in a state like 0.7071 ground state minus 0.7071 excited state. Now, what does that mean, right? And why those weird numbers? Well, those are square root of a half, square root of 0.5. So we'll see in a minute why I picked those numbers that way. And what does minus mean? We know what probabilities are, but these aren't probabilities. These don't add up to 1, right? Add up to 0, actually. So what does that mean? Probability should add up to 1. If you add up the probability of the Chicago Cubs winning the World Series and the probability of the Toronto Blue Jays and then the Texas Rangers, I hope their probability is 0, but it isn't, but it adds up to 1. If you look at Nate Silver's website, they all add up to 1. Probability should add up to 1. These are not probabilities. They're negative, which let's interpret, we have to see what that means, and they don't add up to 1. So when you look at such a system, which is in this unfamiliar linear combination or superposition of 0 and 1, what happens? This is what's going on under the hood. But if you observe it or measure it or interact with it to see, well, is it in the ground state or excited state? You do what you would normally do to tell if an electron's in the excited state or ground state. What happens is those amplitudes, those quantum probability amplitudes, so they're like probabilities, but they're a little more general, you square them. So these become 0.5, a half, or 50%. And you'll see one or the other. You don't see something that feels like that. You see one or the other. With probability 50%, you'll get a ground state. With probability 50%, you'd get the excited state. Right? So there's something a little richer, a little more complicated going on under the hood. But it can explain what we see in our day-to-day experience. Now, right now, you should be wondering, why would you complicate life? What's wrong with probabilities? Well, there's a reason. So a nice example that we can see with the naked eye, you can see with these polarizing filters that my friend and colleague Martin Laforêt from the Institute for Quantum Computing lent me. Polarization. I might need a helper here. Somebody mind coming up to help me with the polarizing filters? Okay, great. I can take one of them, but I need you to hold both of them, but I need just one of them for now, okay? Yeah, you can just hold them, one in each hand, but for now. So this polarizer, the way I'm holding it, the light you see coming off my face is all polarized vertically, okay? Okay, so bring that other filter and put it in front of my face just the same way, like this, okay? So this filter filters anything that's polarized vertically goes through, right? There's no, you see just as much light with or without that filter. Now turn it 90 degrees. So maybe let's do it the other way. You turn that back the way it was, and I'll turn this one 90 degrees. So now all the light coming off my face is polarized horizontally. And I'll keep the filter the way it was, and none of it goes through. So we can just... Right? So you can't see me, right? That's what we have here. So that filter he was holding lets vertically polarized light go straight through 100% of the time, but horizontally polarized light go through 0% of the time. Now, if I go this way, you still see me just the same, right? And that's this state here. But I'll put that filter up just the vertical way, right? You see me, but a little more faintly, right? It's about 50% of the light is going through. Okay. And similarly, if I do it diagonally the other way, making you work.
Sure,
it's good. Thought it was a free ticket, right? All right. See, it's still about, it's the same. So is there any physical difference between the light coming off my face this way or that way? You certainly can't tell the difference if all you're doing is measuring things with the horizontal setting. But let me try something that leads to a paradox, at least an apparent paradox. These are filters, okay? They just... decide, they either let you through or block the particle of light. Take a close look. There's no expensive electro-optical modulators here, right? There's nothing fancy that's changing the phase of this light. Okay. So let's do the thing where, you know, I'm letting only horizontally polarized light. You can't see me. Now put that thing in between these two. Or maybe I can do that. At 45 degrees, if you could hold that at 45 degrees. Okay. Can you see me now? A little faint. You see me, a little more faint, but you still light comes through. So what's going on here? It's a filter. Okay. You get a bit of a paradox, at least at first glance, that doesn't have a very natural explanation in the classical theory. Quantum theory tells us, well, what's going on is the following. 45 degrees, and I think we're done with the... Oh, yeah, we can retake your seat. Thank you. So 45 degrees is actually saying, it's actually 1 over that 0.7071 up, plus, square root of a half horizontal, not up, but vertical. And the other, the minus 45 degrees is square root of a half vertical minus square root of a half horizontal. So I'm claiming that they're not the same, right? But experimentally so far, they look the same. They both, if you just look at them through the horizontal filter, they behave exactly the same. So are they physically distinguishable? Okay, so there's homework here, by the way. There's a quiz in the class right now, and there's stuff I need you to do later when you go home. So, is this, what's coming off my face right now, physically distinguishable from the light coming off my face right now? So who thinks it is? Somebody. Okay. Ideally not a physicist, but if necessary, okay. So most people are saying, no, it's exactly the same, physically the indistinguishable, okay? So I could give you $1 million. So let's suppose we took the pink tape off so you couldn't tell which way I did it, right? So, right, here's, so you can see my face, right? So they are physically indistinguishable. They are physically distinguishable, sorry. That's what that minus sign is there for. Okay, so it doesn't, when you square, you know, you take a minus a number and square it, the minus sign vanishes. So you don't directly see the minus signs in quantum theory, but they determine the results of other, you can indirectly, through some sort of experiment, you know, you could use one of those expensive electro-optical modulators, rotate these things 45 degrees and put them through a horizontal vertical filter, or you can just rotate your filter 45 degrees, a little cheaper. But they are physically distinguishable through some kind of experiment. Another example of quantum mechanics with the naked eye, it's my favorite, is the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So here, these particles, now this, the only cheat here, the main cheat here anyway, is that this is a continuous beam of light. Now in theory and in practice, but it's not very exciting to see one particle of light because you can't really see it. If you could slow this down to one particle of light at a time, click, 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 click. And this particle goes through what's called the beam splitter. Half of the time it goes through, half of the time it's reflected. You know, if it goes through this beam splitter, half of the time it goes through, half of the time it's reflected. So the particles going out of this photon source can take one of four paths. This one, you know, this one, and I forget which one I... Anyway, there's four paths, okay? And they all occur with probability a quarter. Well, actually, that's not what I mean. They all occur with probability amplitude that's square root of a quarter. Okay. This path occurs with probability amplitude minus a half. So square root of a quarter is a half. Okay. This path occurs probability minus a half. This one with probability a half. This one with probability a half. And this one with probability half. I'm sorry if I missed, but... So there's two ways to get here. Okay. Now normally with probabilities, like there's many different... Like when Nate Silver computes Toronto Blue Jays, I think they want an 11 or 15% chance of winning the World Series. There's many ways that could happen. Obviously, they have to beat Texas. But then, you know, it depends who the winners of that next game are and the next game. And then, you know, there's many different paths. And they each have some probability of happening. And if you add up all those probabilities, you get the 11 or 15% figure. That's the current estimate, say. Same thing happens. If you don't look, if you're not looking to see which photon, which path is taken by the photon, you add up the amplitudes. You don't add up the probabilities, you add up those quantum amplitudes, which can be negative. So if you don't look to see which way, if you're always looking at where the photon is going, then it is indeed probability a quarter for each of the paths. So two of the paths go here, so it's a quarter plus a quarter, 50% chance of hitting this. Two of the paths end up here, 50% chance of ending up here. But if you don't look at it, then you don't add up the probabilities, you add up the amplitudes. So you get the chance of coming here, ending up here is a half minus plus, you know, minus a half. So it vanishes. It occurs two different ways. Their amplitudes are the opposites of each other. So this event never occurs. That's why you don't see any red beam here. So a beautiful quantum explanation for this great experiment. Now, we can extend this beyond one bit to, say, 3 bits or hundreds or millions of bits, but let's look at 3 bits. There's 8 ways you can configure 3 bits. They could all be 0, 000, 001, etc., 111. This particular superposition or linear combination, right? There's 3 events that never happen, that aren't there at all. There's one, this is the most likely event, right? The 0.875 squared probability of 100. So if you were to look at these atoms, you'd most likely measure this. The next most likely event is this one, and so on. And the aim of a quantum algorithm, a quantum computer, so what you do is you shine lasers on these atoms. You shine, so this is, again, this is just three atoms. It looks like, you know, 24 atoms, but it's just three. I'm just have this very long-winded way of trying to explain the state of these three atoms. So I just shine light on the first atom, say that flips. If you shine a light with laser, the right laser frequency and intensity, zero will get mapped to one, and one gets mapped to zero. So if you shine that light here, for example, you'll flip the first bits. So now you'll have a 0.401 amplitude 4011, and so on. But you could also do half of that pulse and map this zero into a zero plus one. And what you'll notice is there's many paths. These strings are branching out. They always go to one of the eight strings, but you can go to all the one of the eight strings in countless different ways as you do more and more gates, you know, what we call logic gates, or you know, interactions, more laser pulses on these atoms. And if you want to know after this long computation, shining lasers on these atoms, what's the likelihood of seeing 000, you have to look at all the amplitudes of all the paths that lead you to 000, add them up, and then again, the things could add and subtract. When things cancel out, we call that destructive interference. And when they add up constructively, when you have a bunch of positive amplitudes adding up, or a bunch of negative amplitudes adding up, we don't care about the final sign, we just care about the size of the number, because we're going to square it anyway. Right? That's called constructive interference. Quantum algorithmics is all about choreographing constructive interference on the answer to your problem and destructive interference on the non-answers to your problem, the stuff you don't care about. So you want, you hopefully, you know, if this is a good algorithm, then 100 is the answer to your question. And it's actually very hard to choreograph constructive interference, to choreograph these quantum algorithms. Now, another point I want to make is, so I said this is really just three atoms, but it's kind of a pain. I have to keep track of eight numbers. And then if I have 10 atoms, I need to keep track of 1,000 numbers. And 40 atoms, I need to keep track of 1,000,000,000,000 numbers. I have to keep track of the amplitudes of every possible configuration. So it quickly explodes. This mechanism for keeping for trying to classically simulate a quantum computer, a bunch of quantum bits, also known as qubits, this method is infeasible once you get to 100 or more bits. Again, but that's not to suggest you have the equivalent power of trillions and trillions of classical computers. You don't. But in some very special way, you are able to probe all of these configurations. Right? So what are these good quantum computers good for? It's not a free lunch. It's not like having 8 3-bit computers. For some problems, it is. For some very specific problems, it does appear to be. But in general, it's not what it is. What they're good for is for finding global patterns, global properties, or what I sometimes call seeing the forest without actually observing the trees. I don't mean coarse-grained view of the trees. I mean you have very precise properties of the forest, but you don't know about anything about any of the trees. How can you do that? Well, quantum mechanics allows that. So what do I mean by global property anyway? So here's a math problem. Here's a sequence, 34, 12, 54, 38, 57, 34, 12, 54, 38, 57, 34, 12. It repeats. Every five numbers, it starts all over again. Now, the first five numbers are distinct. Like within the period, it's distinct, but then it repeats. So that's a well-defined math problem. What's the period of this sequence? Well, let's make it a little harder, okay? Let's suppose a sequence of numbers, so these are 128-bit numbers. Okay, so, right, 16 bytes, this is binary, whatever the physical encoding is, we don't care. So the number 1, you know, this would also be encoded in binary on a computer, gets mapped to this pattern. The number 2 gets mapped to some other completely different pattern. The number 3 gets mapped to some other completely different pattern, and so on, and so on, and so on. 729 trillion, you know, 672 million, sorry, 729 billion, 672 million, 482,463 gets mapped to yet another distinct pattern. And then 729 billion, et cetera, and 64 gets mapped to, right? I know I can see it. You've noticed that's exactly the same pattern that one got mapped to. And then that's the cycle, right? And then this is the same as what two got mapped to, and so on. So I'm getting the sense that you profoundly don't care about what those precise patterns were. Right? But if I wanted to classically, on a classical computer, find that period, you know, of the naive way is just to do 700 and whatever billion different calculations. You collect all this garbage data you couldn't possibly care about until you see a pattern. It takes up a lot of memory. There's actually more clever algorithms that take square root of that many steps, right? Roughly a million calculations. And they'll see a collision, they'll see the same pattern. It's like the birthday surprise paradox. If you take about 20-some people in this room, there's high probability that they have the same birthday. Two people have the same birthday. So there's a square root, well-known square root method in computer science and cryptography. So, but that's still a lot of garbage information you don't care about. You just want to know the period. What a quantum computer allows you to do is, you know, you take the 128 bits for the answer, you take about 100 bits or so to encode 1, 2, you know, the n, the number n, you compute the nth pattern. But you do it, you prepare a linear soup, you prepare a combination of all the input numbers, which is an easy thing to do. You have, say, 100 quantum bits, you just make each of them into one of that square root 0 plus square root 1 state. So it's really easy. You just flip, quantumly flip each bit. Those input bits, the bits that encode, you know, the 2 and the 1 and so on, it's very easy to prepare them in a combination of all the possible patterns with a small number of steps. Then you compute the bit pattern. You just do that one computation on this barely, you know, roughly 200 bits. And what you physically embody is, you know, one, the first pattern, two, the second pattern, three, the third pattern, n, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, n, the nth pattern. In those small numbers, in just that one quantum computer, it's somehow in all of those states at the same time, whatever that means. Now, don't look at it. If you look at it, all it does is it effectively collapses to one of those states, and all you get is some random input n and the nth pattern, which you don't need a quantum computer to do, right? You just randomly pick an n and compute the nth pattern in that case. Don't look at it. What you do is you kind of jiggle it and see how it jiggles back. And it's you do what we call a quantum Fourier transform, which is very much like the Fourier transform if you're an engineer or, you know, you're into signal processing and so on. They're very useful for finding patterns and periodicities in signals. So you do actually have what Peter Shor discovered is a very simple sequence of pulses on these bits, these quantum bits. First, this Fourier transform type thing. It's essentially the equivalent of when we went, instead of looking at them, don't look at that photon this way, look at it this way. Okay? That's the one-bit version. The, you know, 128 or 100-bit version is called the quantum Fourier transform. But you're looking at it in a different way. Then what you see is a number which encodes the inverse of the period. Actually, an integer multiple of the inverse period. So you'll either see something that's an approximation of 1 over this large number, or 27 over this large number, some integer over this number. And if you have a good enough approximation of a fraction, there's a well-known method in number theory called the continued fractions algorithm that spits out the fraction. It cleans up the noise. Okay? With a denominator, you pick a denominator size, it'll give you a sequence of fractions that approximate that number, and ultimately you will find that denominator with high probability. So it'll spit out essentially the period. And you only need one. You can do if you do this once, you have a good chance of finding it. If you do it two or three times, your chances get really close to one. So with a very small number of steps, you don't have to do 729 billion or square root of 729 billion steps. You just do one or two or three quantum glimpses at this data, and it will spit out the period. But if somebody asks you, but what was the third or the fourth or the fifth pattern, you'll have no clue because you didn't look at it. You couldn't have looked at it. So you get this global property, but you don't learn any of the details. Now, I'm sensing that nobody in the room really cares about finding the period of large sequences. Not quite nobody. I see at least one famous cryptographer, Ron Mullen, here in the second row, who understands very well what the implications of an efficient period-finding algorithm is, and I'll tell you a bit more about that later. But for most people, it's not that interesting. I'm demonstrating this. This is not so much an interesting, application, but I'm trying to get a sense of what I mean by a global pattern. The applications that would be interesting to most people include simulating quantum materials, right? The kinds of materials that our colleague, Duncan Haldane at Princeton, who's a distinguished visiting research chair here at Perimeter, that he just won the Nobel Prize for on Monday, along with his two other colleagues. Right? They're studying these quantum materials, which offer these new phases of matter, basically. Phase of matter, you have gases and liquids and solids, but quantum mechanics at low temperatures offers entirely new phases of matter that don't depend on temperature, but some other parameters. And if you want to study these materials, it's really, really hard, because you have to study them in a quantum mechanical way. You have to look at how all these configurations, when you want to say what's the probability that after a certain amount of time you end up with this configuration, or this is just an artist, this is a fictitious thing, but that you get a one here, or that you get a certain pattern. You have to explore all the ways to get that result, add up the amplitudes, pluses and minuses, and so on. It's a really hard calculation. Quantum computer can help with some of these questions about quantum materials. Or if you want to study a chemical reaction at the quantum mechanical level, a quantum computer can help. Another example for how a quantum computer can help is searching and optimizing, so-called needle in a haystack problems. Right? So in optimization, and I see famous optimizers in the audience too, we're not literally looking for a needle in a haystack. This is a metaphor for there's a solution to a math problem, something very important. You're trying to optimally allocate a resource. You're trying to design a building to be earthquake-proof. You have money for so many dampers. How should you configure those dampers to maximally protect you against earthquakes? Now, you can try tons. There's countless, exponentially many configurations. Given a configuration, there's models to test how earthquake-proof it is, but you don't have time to go through all of them, right? So these are the kinds of questions we look for that optimizers in industry try to solve. Or there's other problems where, if I give you the answer, you can check it, but good luck trying to find it. If there's no structure, the best thing we can often do is just try all the possibilities until you hopefully find that answer. So these, all these pieces of hay or this, blue needle that I'm not looking for represent are the wrong answers or the non-optimal answers. And this needle is the optimal answer that I'm really looking for. Let's suppose there's just a million possible answers. Usually there's many, many more, but let's say a million. An obvious thing to do is just randomly guess a solution. And you're probably not going to find it. And try again and again and again about a million times, and then you'll probably find that needle. But remember, if you quantumly just guess a random solution, a random place, a random configuration, of a million possible configurations, a million possible ways you can, if you're trying to do airline scheduling or scheduling classes at a university, you look at all those configurations, pick one at random, right? But quantumly pick one at random. Have your quantum computer prepare them all at the same time. Again, don't look at it, because if you look at it, you're just going to collapse to one, a random guess. Remember, quantumly, what's going on underneath is these all exist with amplitude square root of 1 in a million, which is 1 in 1,000, 1 over 1,000, plus or minus. So this idea that Lov Grover at AT&T Bell Labs came up with was essentially saying, don't look, make a quantum guess, but don't look at it. You got the answer with amplitude 1 in 1,000. Then make another quantum guess, but don't look at it either. And another one, and another one, and another one. If you do it, and this is not an easy algorithm to design, but effectively what he came up with was a way, with about 1,000 quantum guesses, without looking at them, he boosted this amplitude to be close to 1, either 1 or minus 1. And then you look at it. Because by then, you've boosted that amplitude to be close to 1, and 1 squared is 1, right? Or minus squared is 1. And you solve that optimization problem with just 1,000 looks instead of 1,000,000 looks. Or if it's a 1 in a trillion problem, you only need about 1,000,000 looks instead of 1,000,000,000 looks. So there's a host of algorithms, there's a host of application areas for quantum searching and optimization that take advantage of what's going on under the hood in quantum mechanics and of these quantum features that I've told you a bit about. There's another interesting feature of quantum mechanics known as, which I'm describing as eavesdropper detection. It's related to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So earlier, I told you I could send light to you in one of four possible states. Can you perfectly distinguish all four of those states? If I don't tell you which of those four I'm choosing, you can try. If you put your filter up this way, you'll be able to tell, you can perfectly distinguish, say, horizontal and vertical, but you'll totally randomize the diagonal. If you put it diagonally, you'll be able to perfectly guess the diagonals, but you'll totally randomize the horizontals and verticals. And you can try everything in between. There's always something that you're going to mess. You can either mess up two things a lot and a couple things not at all, but you'll mess up everything. Or you'll mess up everything a little bit. So there's a minimum amount of disturbance, no matter how you slice it. So if I send one of these four, if Alice, who's trying to establish a secret random string with Bob, if she sends one of those four states through an optical fiber, right? Now when Bob guesses the right, if he guesses, whether horizontal or vertical correctly, he can perfectly, and she sent something that was horizontal or vertical, they can cleanly communicate a bit. And if he correctly guesses the 40 plus or minus 45 degree basis, as we call it, and that's what she sent, they can perfectly communicate a bit. And in the case that they were mismatched, well, they can just discard that data. So if there's no eavesdropper, Alice and Bob can get some perfectly correlated bits. But if there's an eavesdropper, she will necessarily disturb some of those bits substantially. And that disturbance will be detectable by Alice and Bob. Because there'll be an instance where Alice sent a horizontal photon, Bob measured in the vertical horizontal basis, but didn't get the right answer. So they know there was something going on there. And statistically, you can have a very strong estimate of how much Eve has interfered. So she cannot interfere significantly without detection. So this gives Alice and Bob a way to share secret bits. Now most people don't care about secret bits. However, if you're doing cryptography, that's very useful, because secret bits can be put into encryption algorithms to encrypt your information. So if I want to communicate securely, I don't take my message, my valuable secret message, and send it along the optical fiber and have the consolation prize of knowing that it's been hacked. No, I don't do that. I keep it. I send random garbage data through that fiber. I test if it's been spied on. If it hasn't, well, then it was private data now, generic private data. And then I use that secret key to encrypt the data and transmit it securely through an untrusted medium. And quantum cryptography has been developed in numerous technologies over the past decade or more. Switzerland and these other two are from China. And there's others. I just didn't have room for all of them. There's another, one of the other first prototypes is from the United States. And these point-to-point quantum cryptography links have been leveraged into trusted repeater networks. So in the United States, in the Ohio area, they're working on, these would be trusted nodes, right? Same here in Japan, in Switzerland, in China. This is like a 2,000-kilometer chain with a few dozen trusted nodes. So you might say, I don't really want to trust the node. Well, it's a heck of a lot better than having to trust the whole fiber along the way, right? So you can leverage point-to-point quantum key establishment, or what people call quantum key distribution. It's discoverers Gilles Brassard and Charlie Bennett called it. Now, when quantum technology matures to something not quite as sophisticated as a full-fledged quantum computer, but something in between, to something called a quantum repeater, we don't actually have to trust these intermediate nodes. So you can have a purely untrusted infrastructure, and you just verify yourself whether anybody's been tampering with your data, and you establish a key. For now, we have to trust these nodes because we don't have quantum repeaters, and we can't send photons through fiber more than 100 kilometers or maybe 200 kilometers or so. Another strategy for long-distance quantum communication is free space. So there's two natural media for photons. One is through an optical fiber, another is just send it through the air. I mean, you know, there's photons going through the air right now. And they actually can go through relatively unencumbered. And my colleague Thomas Yenevine, just a few days ago, I mean, he's been building his satellite QKD receiver for a number of years now, preparing it and testing it for actually be launched on a low orbit satellite. But just a few days ago, he tested it on an airplane around Smiths Falls in Ontario, Canada. And it worked just fine. And so quantum space science, I first heard of it in the 90s, late 90s, by our colleagues at Los Alamos National Labs. And then a number of colleagues in Europe, including Thomas, started driving a quantum space science initiative in Europe many years ago. And then we recruited Thomas to Waterloo, and he's been driving the Canadian quantum space science program. A big milestone in this field recently, this summer, was China launched the first quantum communication satellite into orbit, which will enable a number of quantum space science experiments, including long-distance quantum cryptography. There's other potential applications of quantum technologies, such as quantum money. This requires, unlike quantum cryptography, QKD, quantum key distribution, which is available with today's technology, quantum money will require a full-fledged quantum computer and stable quantum memory, so not available in the short term. But the idea is very interesting and profound. Digital money is hard to realize. You can't really realize it in practice with classical systems. At least digital money that well reflects today's classical, paper money. Money that can be checked offline without any interaction, without some blockchain, right? Without interaction with a trusted third party. Quantum mechanics could enable that. Because you can't copy quantum states. If you could copy them, you could disturb that. You could measure them without disturbance, right? You just copy it, and you trash the copy, but you have the original, right? So you can't copy quantum states. So quantum money, quantum mechanics gives us a new form of money, say, that could be available in the long-term future. So to sum up the first part of my talk, this new quantum paradigm brings new very exciting positive possibilities. Designing new materials and drugs, simulating chemical reactions at the quantum level, optimization. I haven't even had a chance to talk about sensing and metrology. I mean, one of the reasons we don't have a large full-scale quantum computer yet is these devices are very sensitive, and we still have to figure out how to engineer them to bring the noise levels down to a point where we can scale them into large, reliable systems. But if you're sensitive, then maybe you're a good sensor, and people are working on it at IQC and around the world on next-generation sensors for medical imaging, detecting weak electromagnetic fields, landmine detection, and so on. I've already mentioned quantum communication, and I really think we're just scratching the surface because we don't really have the devices in our hands. There's not, at least not in the wide scale, for people to try things and figure out what the useful applications might be and how they might help us in our lives. We don't have them yet. Just like in the 40s, we certainly didn't imagine applications of computers today. Or in the 80s and 90s, the applications of the internet today were far beyond most of our imagination. Or wireless communications a century ago, who would have thought of what we're using it for today? So I think we're just scratching the surface in terms of what the possibilities are. There is, however, one tiny catch. I mean, we're all eager to seize the wonderful applications of quantum technologies, because it will bring great value to society. Even the things we know of today, and even more when we factor in all the things to be discovered. However, it is a more powerful form of computing. So things like multiplying. So let's go to, in the classical paradigm, multiplication is easy. But if you give me, there are problems that are hard. Like if you give me a large number and ask me what are its prime factors, that takes a really long time on a classical computer. If you give me a 2,000-bit number, so 600 or so digit number, it's beyond current computing. And use the best known algorithms, all the available computing power today, we can't do it. So it's hard. And it turns out a certain form of public key cryptography, a widely deployed form of public key cryptography, is based on this problem being hard. We need this to be hard for those systems, for our internet base today to be secure. There are some other problems. There's this very small group of problems, and others called discrete logarithm-based or elliptic curve cryptography. That's also, these problems are hard on classical computers, and they're a founding pillar of modern-day cybersecurity. The problem is, in the quantum paradigm, and this is where I was starting to feel the heat as a grad student, factoring becomes easy. And if you'd say, oh, but don't worry, there was also these other forms of cryptography, well, those become easy too. Our colleague Peter Shore at AT&T Bell Labs at the time discovered a couple very related algorithms that broke essentially all the deployed public key cryptography methods that we rely on today, all of us, several times a day. So that's bad news. Okay. On the one hand, we want to seize all the wonderful opportunities that quantum technologies offer, but we don't want our cyber infrastructure to collapse. Right? Because we rely on these cyber technologies. Right? These give attackers, if quantum computers are available today, it would have a devastating impact on our cybersecurity infrastructure, which we rely on tremendously today. And just think about how much we relied on cyber infrastructure 10, 20 years ago versus today versus what is it going to be like in 10, 20 years. So devastating impact if one of the foundational pillars of cybersecurity is broken and we're caught off guard and not ready with a failover plan. It's important to emphasize here that there's many ways, there's no such thing as an unhackable system. Okay? There's many ways to hack a system. Breaking the cryptography is in some sense typically the hardest way. Any security system has some physical security assumptions. It doesn't matter if you're using unbreakable crypto, if your window's open and somebody can just look in and see what your secret messages are before you encrypt them, right? Or if there's some spyware they get on your computer. Right? Or if you have an insider who compromises you. So there's always some trust assumptions, physical security assumptions, there's implementation errors, there's all these things. When you read about all these hacks in the newspaper today, they're typically not about breaking cryptography. But we needed that. We need cryptography to be the strongest link. Because crypto is what allows us, it's the only thing that really allows us to take our information and hand it over to an untrusted entity and say, please bring that to the other side of the world for me and give it to my trusted friend. Without crypto, you can't do that. It always has to be in a secured physical box of some sort in the hands of trusted people. You can do that, but it's not very practical for something like the internet to be shuttling our bits around in briefcases with trusted couriers or some sort of equivalent. So cryptography is this wonderful thing that lets us use an untrusted infrastructure. And cryptography is a part that's susceptible to a record now, break it later attack. These other hacks of today are very ephemeral. They're very short-term window of opportunity, typically. You know, these zero-day attacks, you fix them. But crypto, you're handing it over, and for the lifetime of that information, that cryptography better not be broken. And here we're saying quantum computers would break some of the most foundational tools we use to protect our information. So that's a serious problem if we want to take advantage of what the quantum technology offers. Now, what happens if we just wait a little longer and a little longer and a little longer? We've known about this threat since 1994. Okay? The thing is, mitigating this threat is not simple. It's very complicated. It takes a long time. In principle, we have solutions, but they're nowhere close to being ubiquitously deployed in practice. We have ideas that still need to be tested on the chalkboard and whiteboard before they're deployed in products and standards are built around them and integrated into products, hardware and software. So if we wait until it's too late to do this changeover, okay, then we're not just looking at a cyber punch to the face in the future, right? When you break crypto, you're breaking the foundations. There's no patch up. If an insider compromises your system, you at some point you notice it, you get rid of the insider and you can rebuild your system. If there's a security flaw in your software, you find it eventually. I mean, there's damage done, but you then fix it and then you rebuild and you move on. But if your crypto's broken and there's nothing to fix it, then there's nothing to rebuild with. So, I mean, and it's really important to neither underestimate nor underestimate the threat and the risk. Right? So maybe this is a little over the top. The flames aren't going to be quite that high, but we really are talking about a potentially catastrophic failure of our information and communication technology infrastructure if we really do nothing, do not have the failover methods at least ready to go. They don't even have to be deployed per se, but they have to be ready to go quickly when we realize this threat is coming upon us. And for many of these, you know, this could be a problem. Right? So I've told you that quantum computers are still years away. You know, we've known about it since 1994. Relatively little has been done about it, at least in the first decade or so after that. Could we still keep waiting? Do I really need to worry about this now? I mean, the truth of the matter is, there's a lot of real, urgent, important problems in cybersecurity. Real threats hitting us, attacking us day after day after day. So we don't have a lot of spare cycles and energy and so on to be worrying about threats that aren't real or aren't going to, you know, are years and years away. We have lots of time to wait. Is this one of the threats we can put on the to-do later pile? Because we really do have a lot of important things to get done today. Well, that depends. You have to ask yourself, it's not just, is the quantum computer here today? And the answer is, a quantum computer that would threaten cybersecurity, we don't believe they exist today. We think they're still a few years away. Not too many years, but still a few years away. You have to ask your organizations have to ask themselves, what's the security shelf life of the information we're protecting? And this can vary. You could have several different business functions within an organization. So this X can vary even within an organization. So collect all your X's, okay? Your security shelf lives. What's your migration time for your system? To move it to a system, to deploy a system and start using a system that is robust against quantum computers. How many years will that take? This also varies. If it's a really simple system that you fully control, you could do it a lot faster than a very complicated system like the whole internet or something that requires collaboration and cooperation with many vendors, right, and competing companies, and you have deployed hardware that's supposed to be in the field for decades, you know, that's not easy to fix. So this can vary from a small number of years to over 15 years, depending on the complexity of the system, both the technical and social sort of business complexities. And lastly, what is Zed or Z, your collapse time? How many years before these current quantum vulnerable protocols will be broken? We tend to worry a lot about Zed, and we say, well, Zed isn't zero, so wait. But that's not the question. If X plus Y is bigger than Zed, you have a problem today. Every day you procrastinate, every day we wait today, is an extra day of losses in the future. Because for the next Y years, you're stuck with these quantum vulnerable tools. Because we haven't, by definition of Y, we don't have quantum safe, quantum resistant alternatives deployed. You're supposed to, at the end of those Y years, before you finally transition to quantum safe cryptography, offer X years of security, confidentiality. But you're not. So, to recap, if X plus Y is bigger than Z, at some point you're not going to be able to provide the required X years of security. Now, even worse, if Y is bigger than Z and the systems are broken and we don't have a fix in sight, then what? How's the internet going to work? And it's not just about encryption, it's also about authentication. When we download auto updates every single day on our computers to fix network security flaws that are vulnerabilities, if we don't download those auto updates, we're vulnerable. If we do, and how do we know that that is Microsoft and that code is the code that they meant to send you and hasn't been tampered with and had malware injected? You don't care about the confidentiality. You just need to know the origin of that code and that the integrity of that code. It hasn't been tampered with. So this would be even worse problem than X plus Y bigger than Z. Now, there's a lot of hard science, fundamental mathematics, computing, and technology that needs to get done to mitigate this threat. We have ideas for the kinds of, there's two families of solutions here. One is replace these problems based on mathematics and discrete logarithms and so on with different kinds of mathematical problems. But we need to build up confidence that these problems are actually hard against classical as well as quantum computers. That takes a lot of work. And this was not a very fashionable, appreciated area of science for the last few decades. Because we had two things that were working. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, and it was a very small niche field until very recently. A lot of work. And then even when you have, say, a proposal, a mathematical idea, you have to implement it. You have to test it. You have to create standards for it, standardize, you know, and deploy it. It can take many years. As hard as the science and technology challenges are, they're not, as with most problems facing society, the science and technology problems aren't the hardest part, are not the bottleneck, typically. The hardest parts are sort of the social and human sides of the problems. You know, we're not going to deploy these vendors, people who actually deploy information and communication technologies aren't going to invest millions and millions of dollars for something if there's no customers for it, right? So they need a clear signal that people really are serious about protecting their systems against the quantum threat. And that has been lacking for many years. And that led to very slow development, I would say, in protecting against this threat. Fortunately, I think this has been changing recently. About a year ago, just over a year ago, the United States government, the National Security Agency, made a statement saying that a suite of protocols that it uses, that it requires for many of its transactions, will be transitioning to quantum-resistant cryptography in the near future. And that stimulated NIST, one of the most important standards bodies in the world, to initiate a program to start studying and standardizing a possible suite of protocols. We're nowhere ready to decide a winning protocol today, a winning alternative. So that's why their intention is to standardize a handful of alternatives and allow open public scrutiny of these alternatives. We've been working with ETSI in Europe. This is a standard body that brought us GSM and other important telecommunication standards to bring together the community of people who need to work together to solve these really important problems. The scientists, the standards experts, industry, government. We've been meeting now the fourth time. It was in France, Ottawa, Korea, and now Toronto. And at this workshop, the opening speaker from the Canadian government, the deputy chief of our communication security establishment, made a very clear statement that this is important for the Canadian government. And then the chief later that week made a similar statement. This was not a huge injection of money, but it's a very clear statement that sends a message that this is important. I think this will stimulate a lot of the activity. It will start to make it a sound business decision to start taking the quantum threat seriously. So I hope, and we are seeing that as a consequence, information and computation technology vendors are starting to put a transition, a roadmap to quantum safe technologies on their roadmap, as part of their business plans. That's what we need to see, and we're starting to see the early signs of that. So ultimately, the choice is ours. We want to embrace all the positive things that quantum technologies can bring the world. Fortunately, we were made aware very early on that there is this one very negative side effect. Unlike most negative applications of technologies, this has an antidote. That's not usually the case. This has an antidote. We just have to decide to prepare it and deploy it before the large-scale quantum computers become available. And that's a choice. I think the obvious answer is yes, let's have both. We do definitely want to protect ourselves against this emerging quantum threat. Take that threat off the table. So there's really no downside to having a large quantum computer. And embrace all the positive things they will bring, as well as all the other technologies. So there's not just quantum computing. It's not the only technology that quantum mechanics brings. There's the quantum sensing, quantum communication, and much more we haven't discovered yet. And I also want to emphasize that quantum information science and technology is not just about building next generation information and computation technologies, information and communication technologies. Obviously, that's a big part of what's motivating this endeavor, but it's also a very fundamental, profound, and powerful lens through which to study fundamental physics, both the science and the technology. It's a language. Quantum information is yet another paradigm or language with which to understand how information behaves in a quantum mechanical context. And a lot of the fundamental problems facing my colleagues at Perimeter Institute and in physics departments around the world are information problems, like the black hole information loss paradox, for example. And this quantum lens, we just had a workshop here at Perimeter a few weeks ago called It from Qubit. Qubit stands for quantum bit. Hugely successful workshop. Many of the brightest minds in theoretical physics were here. Understanding, if we can understand it, sort of the nature of physics, the nature of the universe, through a quantum mechanical, quantum information lens. And the technology will help as well, because you can formulate theories that are supposed to model reality, but you don't know if you have the right theory if you can't predict the outcome. You have to somehow be able to test the theory. And if testing the theory requires doing a computation that takes forever, you don't even know if you have the answer when you have it. But a quantum computer can, in some cases, help test these theories. There's many examples from the very, very small, from this is a depiction of quantum gravity, certain models, theories for quantum gravity, to quantum cosmology and black holes. Quantum information science and technology is offering a wonderful new perspective on fundamental physics, as well as driving very valuable information and communication technology development. So when I entered the field of quantum computing very reluctantly over 20 years ago, I changed my mind when I realized how profound it was and that it was change. It was a new paradigm and not just a new theory. And when I talked to the physicists who were and learned what kind of experiments they were doing, it was already far beyond what I was aware of. Okay. Still a far cry from what we needed to do quantum computing and many other things. But I realized back then it was really a question of when and not if. And so that's why I personally invested after those 3 whole years I'd been working in the classical paradigm. I started working in this quantum paradigm. But it was a very small community in the mid-90s. A very small handful of what I affectionately refer to as, you know, half-crazy people who profoundly believed this was a very important and meaningful area of science and technology. Now, from the outside world, we weren't half-crazy. it's a little closer to the 100% crazy mark. And I had many people say, like, genuinely trying to save me and say, don't work on that stuff. It's a fad. It'll never work. And I would say, well, because I was a skeptic too, so I'd already gone through all the reasons not to work in the field, and I would typically, what I would notice is they either didn't know a lot about physics or they didn't know a lot about computing, right? So I stuck with it, and I think the bet that many of us made in those early 90s, mid to late 90s was a correct one. This field now has very profound and deep roots. It wasn't a fad. Profound and deep roots. We're building on a wide range of very challenging and profound mathematics, physics, computing, engineering. We're borrowing a whole wide host of human knowledge to build this field. And it's now starting to bear fruits and give back. We're giving a new lens for many-body physics, to study many-body physics, or high-energy physics, and so on. Where it's a new way to understand the power of classical computers. Some very interesting new results for even understanding the power of regular computers based on this quantum information way of looking at computation. So it's giving back to a lot of these disciplines, it's giving back to fundamental science, and it's also producing fruit that is contributing to technology. Yes, it does pose this threat to cybersecurity, but we can not only fix that problem, right? Because the threat, you know, cybersecurity, there's not, a silver bullet fix for this. What you need is a strong cyber immune system, because the threats can come from anywhere in very unexpected ways. So you need a cyber immune system that very quickly recognizes the threats and responds to them. And we don't have a very agile cyber immune system now. We kind of sort of took crypto for granted, and it's baked in a way where it's really hard to change it. So by preparing our cyber infrastructures to be resilient to quantum computers, we're actually making them much more agile and able to react more quickly to any other threats, crypto threats, that would attack them. So we're also, and in addition to replacing our conventional cryptography tools with new cryptography tools based on other mathematical problems, we're adding this extra tool that we didn't think was possible in the classical world. It isn't possible, that we call quantum cryptography. So we're going to make our system a stronger cyber immune system and add a fundamental new tool to ultimately get a cyber, cryptography foundation that is stronger than the one we had before. So it's going to bring a lot to society, both foundational understanding of science, of physics and science and computing, as well as bring us a host of new technologies and improve our cybersecurity infrastructure in the long run. So we're very fortunate, those of us working in this field now, to work in a field that's both intellectually challenging and stimulating, and start to see the fruits bring positive impact on society in the short term. So thanks so much for your attention. I'm really looking forward to the question period.
right, let's open the floor to questions.
Can someone lower this?
Aiden, we'll go to you first. Can you reach up there? There you go.
So you were talking about the person who you not trusted, so you're giving them the information and they can't understand it.
Yeah.
How do you know they're going to give it to them? So, it doesn't matter how well you encrypt it if it never gets somewhere.
So you should be a hacker when you grow up. A good hacker. So that's a very good point. We call that sort of jamming. You can always destroy. So that, you know, let's say we use there's physical means to protect information. We put it in an envelope, we seal it, and we give it to a mailman. The mailman can always feed it to a dog, you know, and the message is gone. So you're absolutely right. Cryptography doesn't solve that problem.
All right, we're going to go quickly online. You've inspired a student, and the question is this. What's the best way for an undergraduate student to get started with a career in this revolutionary field of quantum computing?
Yeah. So it's such a broad field. It spans mathematics, computing, physics, engineering, chemistry, material science. So pick something you really like, pretty much anything that you're passionate about, and pursue that. And then you can pick up the various pieces of quantum information knowledge that you need to complement that. And there's always time to learn more later, but you can pretty much start from any field that you're really passionate about, that you're really good at, and work from there.
That's great, thank you. Let's go back inside the studio here.
David Deutsch claims that the many worlds picture of quantum mechanics is the best way of thinking about quantum information theory. And there's a couple of popular science books that promote that. But from talking to people at Perimeter Institute and IQC, it seems that it's not popular. People don't really use it. Working physicists don't use it. Is that changing with the advent of more people working on quantum information theory or not?
So I'm not sure I agree that it's not popular. I mean, I think many people are very sympathetic to the David's, you know, many worlds, and it's not just David's, many people. I mean, I knew David very well at Oxford. I met him many times. He was my internal examiner, in fact. So we've had many conversations, and I'm actually very sympathetic to that way of thinking. So many worlds, Copenhagen, and all these are interpretations of the same theory. That's to be distinguished from some other people who are saying, here's a different theory with different experimental predictions. But, you know, whether you're many worlds or Copenhagen or whatever of these equivalent, these are interpretations of the same physical theory. My take is pick your favorite one, because they're all ultimately you make the same predictions. And I think the many worlds approach, it has helped some very smart people come up with some very interesting results. Other people have worked in different paradigms and come up with very interesting discoveries. So I'm ultimately agnostic. You know, pick your favorite interpretation that works for you, because they're ultimately interpretations of the same theory. Now, there are people, again, proposing different theories with actual experimental tests. So far, quantum mechanics has always been verified.
Yeah. I just wanted to know if many worlds was in some way more useful than the other interpretations for dealing with quantum information theory.
I think, again, you know, the measure of useful is, does it help you discover new knowledge?
Yes.
And I think it definitely has been. I think, you know, if you talk to Peter Shor, he may have been thinking in a many worlds type paradigm, for example, when he discovered these algorithms.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Let's go to the next question in the studio here.
You've talked a lot this evening about quantum mechanical properties being used for computing, for communicating, for cryptography. Have you and your colleagues been working on other applications of quantum mechanical properties of matter, for example, materials, technologies, transportation technologies, etc.?
Yeah, some of my colleagues are working on quantum materials. We have a whole new suite of labs on the north campus of our university dedicated to, you know, studying and implementing experiments related to quantum materials.
Is anybody looking into possible transportation technologies?
What do you mean exactly?
Quantum teleportation.
I see. So I didn't talk about teleport because I didn't have time, and I see I already went somewhat over time. Teleportation is not about teleporting matter. It's about sending information, quantum information, reliably using only a classical communication channel. So it's not a transportation tool.
Let's take one last question from inside the theater.
In the calculations you've shown us, they seem to assume a repetitive, consistent sequence. And I'm wondering if a quantum analysis can identify minute chaotic events. And in terms of practicality, I'm wondering if a quantum tool could be developed to analyze voting machines where a third party, either country or hacker interest, could inject votes in a consistent way. Would a quantum tool be able to identify that?
So, are you talking about online voting or just the electronic voting that people actually go to the booth and?
I guess both really, because the a partisan interest can own the voting machine. So that can be. Analyzed possibly for minute chaotic events that may indicate some kind of interference. But so, when I saw the way that you showed going to square roots, it seemed to me that it's at such a magnification that those minute chaotic events may not be transparent in any way.
So the period finding is an example of the kind of thing we know it's good at. We certainly don't understand, I think, everything a quantum computer could be good at. I think what you're referring to is more about, can quantum sensing technology detect intruders better?
Well, that was my second question.
Yeah.
But the first one, just in terms of a quantum analysis and the way that it seems to assume consistency in whatever the sequences are, chaotic theory has had an impact, let's say, on analyzing markets where, algorithms were developed that didn't take into account chaotic events.
So maybe, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question, so we could probably take it offline, but let me say one more thing where that might be related to your question. A lot of cybersecurity is about detecting anomalies. So you collect all this the sensor data about what's going on in your network and who's doing what and when, and you try to, then you have algorithms that say, is there something wrong with this picture, right? Why is this person who's never worked at 3 a.m. in their life suddenly downloading terabytes of data? And that's an easy thing to detect, but there's maybe more subtle patterns. And the data analytics behind cybersecurity, it's conceivable that quantum algorithms might help with that. But, what I'm personally... Like the problem is you need a quantum computer to deploy that sort of help. We need today to deploy things that don't require a quantum computer, but will protect us in an era when we do have quantum computers. So most of my thinking is in this David versus Goliath model, where we have to deal with these primitive tools, either classical, conventional cryptography, resilient to quantum attacks, we hope, or quantum cryptography with primitive. I mean, it's very sophisticated, advanced stuff, but it's certainly a precursor to a large-scale quantum computer, much easier to implement. So I'm mostly thinking in this framework. And could a quantum computer be useful for the data analytics? Someday, perhaps, but we don't have time to wait for that. But I'm probably not answering your question, but it might be easier to just discuss offline to see if I can understand it better. Thanks
very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Michael Mosca, thank you.